seated. Good morning. I want to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. We have a case at 11 o'clock that will be orally argued. Before we begin, it's my understanding the attorneys are all present and ready. And I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. And I'm Bonnie Sutterth. I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we begin, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Cynthia Bearden versus Jared LeClaire et al. Who may receive the court, Mr. John Casey, to argue for the appellant. Mr. John Cruz, to argue for the appellant.
Mr. Casey?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. It's good to be here after about 5 days. With the court's permission, I plan to devote the majority of my time to discussing the liability issues. Unless the court has questions on the damage issues, I'll leave those to the briefs, including the reply brief that we filed timely yesterday. Hope the court got an opportunity to review that. I want to start by acknowledging that I'm well aware that the factual narrative in our brief reads something like a daytime soap opera. There's a lot of he said, she said, there's plots and subplots and an endless cast of characters. And I know it's easy to get lost in a story like that. I was just commending Mr. Cruz for the excellent brief that I thought he wrote. I'm not sure it added anything in terms of clarity. So what I hope to do is cut through some of that and focus the court's attention on what we believe is the evidence bearing on, or the dispositive evidence bearing on, the sufficiency complaints that we've raised as to the liability findings. Malicious prosecution. Y'all know that there's several elements the plaintiff has the burden of proving, that the defendant commenced the criminal proceedings, that the plaintiff was found innocent, or what the prosecution terminated in the plaintiff's favor, that the defendant harbored malice against the plaintiff, and that there was an absence of probable cause for commencing the criminal proceedings. And of course, there's a presumption that probable cause exists for the purpose of protecting society's interest in encouraging citizens to report crimes, whether they be real or perceived. The only element at issue in this appeal is the absence of probable cause, that is, whether Mr. LeClaire produced legally or factually sufficient evidence of an absence of probable cause. Stated another way, whether there is conclusive evidence establishing that Ms. Bearden had probable cause. Whichever way you look at it, we submit that Mr. LeClaire did not and cannot establish that element as a matter of law because of his admissions and other undisputed evidence on the objective elements of the crime that was charged. I want to direct the court's attention to tab A of our oral argument handout, as well as tab B. And under tab B is a copy of the Martin case, which we believe is on all fours in this case. And I wanted to just take a brief moment to explain why. I don't feel like we treated it as well as we could have in the brief. In Martin, the plaintiff claimed that the defendant bank maliciously prosecuted him by complaining to law enforcement authorities that he committed a theft under the penal code. It's a different theft regarding security pledge for loan. Like Mr. LeClaire, Martin was arrested, indicted, but the charges were eventually dismissed. And a judge and jury in Cameron County awarded him $18 million. The Corpus Christi Court of Appeals reduced that award to approximately $4 million. The Supreme Court reversed, holding that because the objective elements of the crime of theft were established by Mr. Martin's admissions, he could not establish absence of probable cause, as he must do to to maintain a cause of action for malicious prosecution. The court went on to hold that since Mr. Martin admitted the objective elements of the crime, he couldn't prove the bank lacked probable cause by pointing to the bank's failure to inquire about whether he had some alibi or explanation for what he did, by the fact that the bank provided false or incorrect information to the grand jury, or the fact that the bank failed to disclose material facts to the grand jury. Some of the allegations that are similar to ours here. The court said those facts may be relevant to malice or causation, but they, quote, have no bearing on probable cause. And if you look at the chart under tab A, I believe tab A, that chart illustrates that this is precisely the situation that we have here. Mr. LeClaire admitted at trial that he appropriated Ms. Bearden's property. He took the $18,500 that she gave him for the horse and deposited it into his bank account. He admitted that the day before he deposited the money into his bank account, Dr. Dugan, the owner of the horse, told him to hold up and not to complete the sale or deposit the money. Mr. LeClaire admitted that he ignored those instructions and went ahead and deposited the money and spent it on his own debts. And he even admitted at trial that if Dugan told Bearden, which he did, that LeClaire did not have authority to sell the horse, Bearden had every right in the world to file a criminal charge against him. We would submit that these admissions establish every element of the crime under Section 3103 of the Penal Code, and based on Martin and the Ritchie case on which it relies, Mr. LeClaire could not establish absence of probable cause. None of the evidence that Mr. LeClaire points the court to is raising a reasonable or creating an inference from which the jury could find that an absence of probable cause is probable cause evidence. It all bears on malice, possibly causation. Ms. Bearden was, the record's clear, she was angry at Mr. LeClaire. The record shows she had a relationship with Dr. Dugan and they had this so-called secret agreement. None of that evidence, none of it, is evidence of probable cause. It may prove that Ms. Bearden harbored malice and ill will toward Mr. LeClaire, but it has no bearing on probable cause. So that's why we would ask the court to reverse and render the judgment on the malicious prosecution claim. The jury's defamation finding suffers from very much the same problem, and that is it's contrary to Mr. LeClaire's admission at trial that the statement that he did not have authority to sell Electric Surge was not false or was substantially true. If you look at tab C, D, and E, actually, all of those handouts pertain to this particular defamation claim. Tab C is a chart similar to tab A, just to kind of illustrate, here's the admission, here's the statement that was the basis throughout trial for their defamation claim. Tab D contains highlighted excerpts from Mr. LeClaire's testimony where he unequivocally admits that Dr. Dugan told him to hold up on completing the sale of Surge the day before he negotiated the checks and spent the money on himself. This admission is corroborated by testimony of Dr. Dugan himself. He told Ms. Bearden sometime in April, I believe, after the transaction took place, that he did not authorize him to sell the horse. And there's some text messages under tab E that reflect and corroborate the same thing.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. If I'm correct, there's not a written contract anywhere in the record for Ms. Bearden to have bought Electric Surge. Is that correct?
No.
So at what point in time was that contract enforceable? When was the deal actually made?
The unwritten contract, at what point in time would it have been enforceable?
Yes.
Oh, that's a good question. I know that was issued at trial. Mr. LeClaire, I believe, said that he thought the sale had been completed when he took the checks and before he heard from Dr. Dugan. I don't mean to evade the question, Your Honor, but I'm not sure it really matters when we're talking about the malicious prosecution claim and whether there was evidence of the objective elements of the crime, which is appropriation, taking the money without her effective consent. Of course, she wouldn't have given him money had she known that Dugan told him to hold up the sale.
But she had already given him the money.
Had she known.
She had already given him the money.
She gave him the checks. He right. hadn't deposited them yet.
Right. He was. But she didn't know that.
She didn't know that at the time. That's correct. Right. And she was deceived into thinking that he had full authority to take her money, deposit it, transfer the title to the horse. And, of course, she never got the papers. And the point about, well, she could have gone to Dugan. Dugan said, I'm not giving any papers until I get my money. So, no, she didn't know that at the time. That was the deception.
You say under tab C that LeClaire admitted that Dugan told him to hold up on completing the sale.
Correct.
Well, when was the sale going to be completed if he'd already taken the checks? Is the sale complete?
You know, Your Honor, our position would be the sale would have been completed when consideration passed and it was exchanged and the money was deposited, papers were provided, the sale would have been completed at that time. But she gave him post-dated checks. The owner said, don't sell, in so many words. He went ahead and took the money, put it in the bank, and never gave her the papers. So the sale was not complete because of those subsequent facts.
But
I know Mr. LeClaire has taken the position that he believed that the sale was complete, but again, when we're talking about malicious prosecution, what Mr. LeClaire thought about the sale is irrelevant. And the evidence shows that Ms. Bearden found out that he did not have the authority to take that money and deposit it. And that's undisputed.
Who did she think she was buying this horse from, LeClaire or Dugan? Who did she think had title, if you have title to a horse?
I believe the record reflects that she knew Dugan on the horse. Yeah. But it was customary in the industry for this type of transaction to take place, and an industry-imposed duty on the so-called agent or trainer to provide the papers. But it put Ms. Bearden between a rock and a hard place. Dugan hadn't gotten his money because Mr. LeClaire kept it, put it in his bank account. He said, I'm not going to give you the papers. And I understand why he would say that. I'm not going to give you the papers until I get my money. So they entered into this agreement, this so-called secret trump card agreement or trump agreement, whatever. Who wouldn't? Who would not, when they feel like they've been swindled, do what they can to try to force the person who swindled them to do what's right?
Well, didn't Mr. LeClaire offer to give Ms. Bearden her money back?
Excuse me?
Didn't Mr. LeClaire offer to give Ms. Bearden her money back?
He did. But that doesn't mean that the objective elements of the crime were not established. She didn't want the money. She wanted the horse. He took the money without authority. He deposited it. It was appropriated. It was without her effective consent. That's all this is about. He did offer that, but you're talking about Mr. LeClaire, of course, and we don't know from the record. I mean, you could draw an inference from the record. He didn't have the money to, follow through on that. That was just, empty promises. Very quickly, let me just turn to the defamation. We believe the defamation finding suffers from the same problem. and that it's contrary to LeClaire's admission at trial that he did not have the authority to sell Electric Surge, that the statement that he did not have the authority to sell Electric Surge was not false or was substantially true. In tab C, D, and E, tab D contains the excerpts from his testimony where he admits he was told to hold up, not to complete the sale, not to deposit the money. Tab E contains text messages where Dugan himself, you know, says don't do it. It's where Dugan says don't complete the sale. Text messages just corroborating the lack of authority. So as a matter of law, we contend that the statement was not false. Even if it was, even if the court were to find that it was not substantially true, Ms. Bearden went to Dr. Dugan, Ms. Bearden went to Mr. LeClaire and asked them, and they confirmed what she believed at the time. So thank you, Your Honor.
Would you add an extra minute to the appellee's time, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I will probably also focus my time on the liability questions. Although I would be happy to entertain questions about the damages if it comes up, or if the court has questions about those later. I want to start with a first principle that I think both sides agree on, which is that the probable cause is measured by the crime that was charged in this case. We have two places to look for that. One of them is question one of the jury charge, where the jury is told what the crime charge was, and it was the wrongful appropriation of Ms. Bearden's money. And the other is the indictment, which has similar language. There are a number of arguments that have been made by the appellant that blur together the interests of Dr. Dugan and the interests of Ms. Bearden. Those are not technically correct. I think that in order to have the malicious prosecution, all we had to focus on was whether there was probable cause of the crime that was actually charged. So if hypothetically the appellant were to show that there had been some other crime committed against Dr. Dugan, that would not be responsive to the claim that we have brought. We don't think they have, but I just want to get that first principle out of the way because I think it simplifies a number of the arguments that have been made. And you see this especially in the reply brief, where there are statements such as LeClaire did not have the effective consent of Bearden and Dugan, or LeClaire deposited money belonging to Bearden and Dugan. There's a sort of a blurring of the two. And I'd like to help the court think about how to untangle that a little bit. And I think the court is cognizant of this. And I think I may be able to connect some dots. But it's the chronology of the deal and what we're talking about here and how that relates to the proving malicious prosecution. It's undisputed that everyone agrees that the transaction happened in December, that was a time when Mr. LeClaire, with Dr. Dugan's authorization, went to Ms. Bearden, offered to sell Dr. Dugan's horse to her for the same price he had purchased it for recently. Everyone agrees it was a fair price. Everyone knew this was the deal at the time. The consideration for the deal was his promise to give her the horse, and she gave two post-dated checks, which are negotiable instruments. I think we heard that word in the opening. And at that point, really, the contract is made. And everyone's understanding was that as of January 1st, Ms. Bearden would own the horse. And that is reflected, I think our brief outlined some of the documents that reflect that happened. That's when she started her insurance. That's when the billing started. Everyone's understanding was that as of January 1st, that transaction had happened. She was the owner of the horse at that point. We do have this text message from Dr. Dugan on January 3rd, where he's trying to renegotiate parts of the financial arrangement between him and Mr. LeClaire that was untangling already at that time. But that is not a time machine. It doesn't go back in time and take away the authority for the sale. And no one claimed that it did until May. And this is important, I think, because in January, everyone behaved as if Ms. Bearden owned the horse. Late January, Dr. Dugan got a credit on his statement, as had been discussed, for the price of the horse to reduce his debt to LeClaire Performance Horses. February, everyone behaved as if Ms. Bearden owned the horse, and the same is true in March. So when we reach April, late April, at the time of this conversation with the Trump Card Agreement, which was Ms. Bearden's term for this, where she claims to have learned for the first time some information, she already had 4 months of knowledge. She already had experienced 4 months of time in which Dr. Dugan had not asked for the horse back, had not claimed that there had been no authority. I think at one point in the appellant's brief, it's described that she was shocked to have learned that, that it was inconsistent with what she had known before. What I want to point out to the court are two ways that connects to things. The first is the contrast between her story and the story that she knew to be true and what she told the grand jury. And we have the unusual situation where we know precisely what she told the grand jury. She told the grand jury that she purchased the colt from Jared. She said the colt had not been truly for sale and that the owner had never given authority, had never given permission, and that the original owner wants the horse back. And all of those things were false, and she knew them to be false based on her having lived through it as a participant in the transaction the whole time. Now, of course, what she says to the grand jury is not what proves up probable cause. The question of proving probable cause, I think both sides agree, is accurately framed by question one of the jury charge. I think the appellant's brief in a footnote agreed that this framing of it was correct. The definition of probable cause, that's on page 1295 of the record, is focused on the facts and circumstances within his knowledge at the time the prosecution was commenced. And the question is whether a reasonable person, so that's an objective element, would believe that a crime had been committed given the facts as the complainant honestly and reasonably believed them to be before the criminal proceedings were instituted. So, I think much of the reply brief and much of the trial strategy of the appellant was trying to set this case up as a kind of closed book moot court problem almost, with a couple of facts that they could point to and say, based on these three facts, wouldn't you, witness, agree there had been a crime? They asked questions like that of the prosecutor, and he was savvy enough to respond, if those are true, that would be a crime. They asked that of other witnesses, and I don't know that their opinion is particularly weighty on that question, but they were each given this kind of a moot court problem of just a few elements. And that's what the appellant has set up for you in their oral argument exhibit here, pointing to three things they say are the three facts that matter. But what the law asks you to look at are the facts and circumstances within Ms. Bearden's knowledge at the time the prosecution was commenced. So let the jury evaluate what she honestly and reasonably believed. So in May, she didn't just know what Dr. Dugan had told her in the process of forming this conspiracy. She had lived through the transaction. She knew that she'd purchased the horse in December. She knew that Dr. Dugan knew she'd purchased the horse. She'd lived through months of time in which Dr. Dugan never claimed to not have given authority. She knew that Dr. Dugan had never asked for the horse back, and she admitted that Dr. Dugan never asked for the horse back. These are facts that weigh on the question of probable cause, because she is not a person who just has that set of three facts. And one of the things I've noticed researching malicious prosecution cases is that a lot of the cases that come up tend to be shoplifting cases. And they tend to present almost that kind of moot court problem, where you have a store manager who sees with his own or her own eyes somebody take an object, put it in their jacket, and walk out, or one of their employees sees the same. And so those are all the facts. And when you truly have a problem like that, you can end up in a situation like you have in Ritchie or in the Martin case, which I'll talk about in just a minute, where it's possible to evaluate probable cause as a matter of law, and it's possible to say that that's all the complainant needed to know. That's nothing like what we have here. We have someone who has far more information about what happened in the transaction.
She didn't see the text by which Dr. Dugan authorized the sale until after she testified in front of the grand jury and had the Facebook post.
I think that's true, but I just don't think it matters, because that is an incontrovertible piece of evidence that he couldn't deny, but she lived through it. She knew, she was interacting with Dr. Dugan at the barn. They would cross paths. They had interactions over that time. So I don't think she needed to have seen the text message to know. And I think we discussed this in our brief, but it's, and the jury could certainly take this into consideration in evaluating what she honestly believed, is that when she learned about that text message, she did not feel that she had been deceived by Dr. Dugan. It wasn't a situation where she thought, oh no, if I'd only known about this text message, I would not have gone along with this trump card agreement. Her anger was directed at the prosecutors, and she continued to work with Dr. Dugan. So I think that would also bolster the idea that this was not a surprise to her, that it had been authorized at the time that she bought the horse and the time that she became the owner of the horse. I do want to talk about the Martin case and how it fits into, I'd put the sequence of the Ritchie case, and then we have the Martin case and the Subaru case. And in the Ritchie case, we have a shoplifting case. And the court concludes that where the store manager observed Ritchie leave the store without paying for an item in his possession, the store employees had what they call no duty to inquire into Ritchie's state of mind. I think that's a correct statement of the law. You've seen all the information you have is that a crime has been committed. You don't have to go ask for an excuse or an alibi. In the Martin case, they cite the same proposition, and they really have the same kind of situation. And what they do not say that these other facts are irrelevant or immaterial. What they say is that when the objective elements of a crime appear to have been completed, a private citizen has no duty to inquire whether the suspect has some alibi or explanation. So again, it's a question of whether you have a duty to go get more information than you already have. It's not absolving you of responsibility for the information that you do already have from having lived through the transaction, from months of experience, and in this case, from other communications with Jared LeClaire. And the Subaru case is, I think, where this ends up, and it's a couple of years after the Martin case. And we discuss it at some length in our brief. But I think what's most significant is that the court is not applying Martin in the way that I believe the appellant is suggesting that you apply Martin. In the Subaru case, the court is looking at whether that record has evidence suggesting that Kroger could have honestly and reasonably believed that the person had the intent to shoplift. It's taking seriously that question based on the evidence in front of it. And it's looking, we discuss it as the presumption, but the kinds of factors that it's talking about are whether there are prior bad relations, pre-existing debt, private motivation to harm, whether there was time for the employees to have caucused together to have formed some kind of plan, whether there was some evidence that someone had intentionally withheld exculpatory information. And those are precisely the kinds of things that this record has in abundance. I don't really think that's in much dispute anymore, that if it's proper for the court to look at these kinds of factors to determine if there was a basis for the jury to disbelieve Ms. Bearden, then I think we have, we do have sufficient evidence to show probable cause under Subaru. I don't think there's any way to read the Subaru case and not believe that it is the defendant's state of mind that is, the defendant meaning Ms. Bearden's state of mind, that is really pivotal in this. And you look at that, you do start with the presumption of good faith, but as the cases say, that presumption, we're using the cases is that it disappears when the plaintiff produces evidence. We've gone far beyond that. And the jury heard the testimony, and I believe they were well within the evidence in concluding that Ms. Bearden did not honestly and reasonably believe in May that Jared had committed a theft when he did that deal with her back in December or January. I do want to talk about this idea that the appellant is dwelling on, suggesting that there have been some admission of the objective elements of the crime. At the big picture, we disagree with that because I think we disagree about what the transaction was and when it happened. If I look specifically at what they have in their first tab of their oral argument book, they suggest that LeClaire admitted he appropriated Bearden's property. And the record citation there was, I had a few minutes to look this up before the argument, is to a bit of testimony about him depositing it in the account for LeClaire Performance Horses. Of course, the check was made out to LeClaire Performance Horses. This was not subterfuge. And the chronology of what happened in this case, that the deal was done before this happened. Certainly as to Ms. Bearden, but I think overall, the deal had been completed. There's evidence in the record the jury could have credited that Jared LeClaire and Dr. Dugan had an understanding that Jared could sell this horse for him and take those funds and credit it to his bills. Jury heard that evidence. That's exactly what happened. There's nothing about this that is criminal or wrong or even a breach of any kind of contract or agreement. If Dr. Dugan wanted to renegotiate, as I think is abundantly clear from the record, he continued to try to do for months, he could do that. But that doesn't, it's not a time machine to go back in time and to make Jared's actions criminal. And I think that also explains the second bullet point that they have here, the suggestion that LeClaire admitted that the day before he deposited it, Dugan told him to hold up, to not complete the sale or deposit the money. Bearden owned the horse, as we've discussed in our brief. She had a way to get the paperwork from Dr. Dugan, who owed it to her. We think there's an industry custom that normally an agent would be able to do this, but Dr. Dugan didn't want to allow that to happen. The sale, I think, had been completed before that time. And certainly the jury had evidence to understand the sale had been completed before that time. And the third bullet point they have here is a suggestion that Mr. LeClaire admitted that if Dugan told Bearden that LeClaire did not have authority to sell, Bearden had, quote, every right in the world to file a criminal charge against him. And they cite to volume 11, page 67 of the record. I guess the two things I want to say about that are the first is that this is really framed as one of these moot court problems where it's not looking at all the information that Ms. Bearden had. If truly the only thing she knew was some piece of information like that, she would be in a very different position than someone who had experienced it, had firsthand knowledge, understood what I think the jury charge in the case law called the circumstances in which that information was being provided to her. She knew it was being provided to her in the context of someone wanting to make a secret deal with her to get a larger civil settlement by threatening criminal charges. I mean, that kind of circumstance should cause a reasonable person to doubt what they're being told. But the second thing I want to point the court to, I think, is the court does go down this path in considering it, is that if you look at that page of the transcript, you actually look at around page 66 to 72 of volume 11, you can see the context of what this is. This is a time in the trial when the Ms. Bearden's attorneys are showing a deposition transcript to Mr. LeClaire, and asking him about questions he had given in 2014 about a pleading he had on file in 2014. And what becomes clear in the colloquy on those pages is that those deposition questions were about a pleading that had already been withdrawn before that. So it's sort of two levels removed from any contention that he was making in this case or admission he was making in this trial. And he goes on to say that he does not believe the same today, 72 or 73. I can briefly address defamation, but I think there really is a question of sort of the scope of the defamation issue that's been presented to the court. I know that it's I don't know whether to call it waiver or a question of the scope of the briefing, but I do think it's evolved since the opening. We really haven't been able to brief this question of substantial truth or falsity in a vacuum, but I don't know that we need to because I think the same evidence that explains why Jared LeClaire had authority to sell the Dugan's horse to Bearden in December shows that the statement in the post was false and was not substantially true. What the evidence is that Ms. Bearden had arranged for this whole thread to be created. And the thread begins with, has someone had a trainer steal from them? And Ms. Bearden begins, yes, that happened, exact same thing happened to me.
Let me ask you a question on a different subject. In their reply brief, they say LeClaire admitted he could not identify one client or potential client he lost because of anything Bearden did or said with respect to the reputational injury damages. Is that
identify? I think identify is the key word. We did not have evidence at trial pointing to it by name, is what I think the next question asked him, if you could do it by name, a specific client who said, I heard you were indicted for theft and decided not to bring a horse. We don't have a discrete individual example. We proceeded in the way that some other cases have approached the proof, where you can show the broader pattern and explain the timing and the causation. And we have evidence from other trainers about the effect it had in the community. We have other testimony about the way it affected at horse shows, which is where you gain clients, and the reduction in his business that followed. I see that I'm out of time. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Court some time back, since I took a minute over. deal was done. The sale's been completed. We heard that all morning. If someone sells you or gives you a written contract and you sign it, you agree to pay so much money. You later find out that that person did not have authority by the owner to sell the car. Are they really contending that that's not an appropriation without the buyer? And that's all that this is really about. Now, we can talk all day long about when was the sale complete or not. The question is, was there authority at the time that the sale was made to sell that horse?
Well, wasn't there? In December, there was authority. Isn't that the fact of the matter?
In December?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, if you're going to, if the December there was discussion about the sale, the transaction.
Well, let's look at the facts from the light most favorable to the verdict.
Consideration was not paid, was not given until the money was handed over to Mr. LeClaire after that point in time.
But
and
there
then,
are.
And then Mr. Dr. Dugan, the owner, said, don't sell, hold up.
Right, but the deal was already done, wasn't it? The authority had been given to make the sale.
Contract based on what happened in December about the discussions about the horse. No, Your Honor, we don't believe that would be the law.
But that is the quintessential question. Was that an enforceable contract in December? Because if it was, then the deal was done.
Well, we have taken the position that it was not an enforceable contract. There was no consideration paid. There was nothing that would have lend itself to enforceability in a court of a civil court of law.
Well, didn't Ms. Bearden give those post-dated checks? There was something about for tax reasons to make the sale effective January 1st. So presumably, she gave those checks to Mr. LeClaire before December 31st, right?
Gave the checks to Mr. LeClaire
before January 1st. I mean, she.
No,
because they were post-dated, checks, weren't they?
The checks were handed to Mr. LeClaire on the 1st, I believe. January.
Well, how would they be post-dated if they were handed on the 1st, if they were dated the 1st?
No, they were dated, I'm sorry, they were dated the 3rd.
One was the 2nd, one was the 4th, I think.
The phone call to Mr. Dugan or the text.
Well, if they were handed on the 1st.
January 3rd, the checks were handed on January 1st.
Well, then why they had to be post-dated for tax reasons if they were handed on January 1st? Okay.
That's, again, we're getting off of the objective elements of the crime. This is a closed book. If you read Martin. Martin doesn't get into the reasonable man standard because under the city of Keller, when you have undisputed evidence and or admissions to the fact to which the jury is supposed to be determining, the jury cannot disregard that. That's what does make this a closed book case.
Wait a minute. His argument is that the forest, rather than your trees, shows that she didn't have a reasonable belief that Mr. LeClaire had stolen from her.
That, well, Your Honor, I'm not sure I heard the whole question. What was your question?
He's saying if you look at the whole kit and caboodle here, she didn't have a reasonable belief that Jared had stolen her money, not whether or not there's an enforceable contract or post-dated checks or things like that.
Well, if you're going to ignore the admissions, and you're going to just put the city of Keller analysis aside, the standards aside, and you're going to look at the reasonable man standard. That's what you're talking about. It's you're not getting into her head. What you're doing is you're supposed to be, the jury was supposed to be judging the facts as she knew them at the time based on a reasonable man standard. That's an objective standard. It's not a subjective standard. They want to make it into a subjective standard and get into her head, and but it's what would a reasonable person believe given the facts that she knew at that time? That's the standard.
Because of all the facts that he's laid out before us, the jury couldn't believe that there was should be some objective doubt in her mind that LeClaire had stolen from her.
If a reasonable man would have some doubt about it, that's the standard, not whether she did or not. It's a reasonable man's standard. Thank you all. I appreciate it. We pray that the judgment be reversed and rendered or remanded.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your arguments. It's been helpful. Your case has been submitted. We're now in recess.
All rise.